Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour, December 30th, 2010, last show of the year 2010. And I remember as this year began and as 2009 ended last year, I remembered saying, wow, am I glad to see 2009 gone. Woo! Not that I like to see time going away quickly, but 2009 was a crazy, crazy year. And just due to all of the, you have to understand, and this is one of the points I try and make on this show, all of the activity that is going on in the background, and the people in control who are doing all kinds of bizarre, strange things to maintain that control. So at any rate, for that reason, 2009 was a very strange year. But 2010, oh my goodness, just probably hit a new level for strangeness. But what I'm going to try and do is just highlight a couple things here. I don't want to dwell on it because what we have to do, what I have to do, what you have to do, what all of us have to do is realize that the level of misinformation is just over the top. It is just unbelievable. And going back to many of the old hack ideas, just trying to promote those so that we are on a, trying to keep the public obviously at bay. And there's a lot of people who buy off on it. You know, I call my audience the 5%ers, and a lot of times I really think it's more like the 0.5%ers, the 0.5% percenters, so to speak. Because, you talk to people on the street, and they just have no clue at all. Absolutely no clue what is going on this planet. And so anyway, as I said, I don't want to dwell on that. But heading into 2011, what should a person do? First of all, through all of this, the one thing you want to do is make sure you are happy, that you can put a smile on your face, that you are surrounded by people who truly love you and really are interested in you and being with you, and you're part of their entourage or group or whatever you might want to call it. So that's kind of number one. You have to have a core group of people, and that might be family, it might be friends, it might be groups come in strange ways sometimes. But a lot of times when things get a bit funny or rough or unusual, you find out that the people you thought were your best friends are not, and the people who you thought weren't friends at all turn out to be your best friends, the ones that you can count on, so to speak. And they're very quiet. I remember coaching one time some women, actually, and we were talking about this. And I said, you always seem to jump for the guy who makes the most noise and da-da-da-da-da, always got the fun things to say, etc. And you avoid the guy that's quiet, sitting in the background. And sometimes the people that are talking all the time, with all the fanfare, have the least to say, and the person who says the least has the most to say. And they responded and they said, well, how do we approach people? Because these guys are, we were talking about relationships. And these women said, well, these guys are, they don't stop, they don't go away, and so we end up going out with them and then they're really not good people. And I said, get a clue. You have to figure out who's who. It's not just because somebody jumps up and down and gives you a good story. And, so the point is that life is much the same. A lot of people go for the fanfare, who has the most, in the science world, who has the most credentials, who has the most publications, who has the longest list of books published for the public, etc. And the point is that life is somewhat almost like a dating game. in which you are trying to find those elements of life which are good for you. And a lot of times there things are presented to you with a lot of fanfare, a lot of gloss. And if one were to simply start out looking at, say, the internet or other sources of information, wow, would you be in for a rocky ride, a ride that just wouldn't quit. So at any rate, it's important to understand who's who, and that's what I try and do on this show. I try and separate the chaff from the wheat, and in this case, I think there's lots more chaff than wheat in the world today. But 2010 was no exception. We had another comet fly by, for example, once again proving conclusively that comets are not dirty snowballs. But the other day, I did a search on the internet. I just pulled up a couple of the main search engines, and I just typed in comets. And so let me just kind of review what I pulled up here. I've got one of the screens handy. And interestingly enough, this was on the 28th of December, that the SOHO Solar and Heliospheric Observatory, which is a satellite looking at the sun, discovered its 2000th comet and near the sun. The SOHO Observatory searches near the sun and looks for all kinds of solar activity. But as a viewer of the sun, it sees many comets. It's just so it has discovered 2,000 since the year, and almost 15 years ago, December 2nd, 1995, it was launched, and it went into service shortly after. So apparently this 2000th comet occurred on December 26th, the day after Christmas, 2010. And so in 15 years, it has discovered 2,000 comets near the sun. Now, that always struck me as unusual, too, that the most prolific location to find comets, which are supposedly little ice balls, is right near the sun. Now, you can put your hand out on a sunny day, and you can measure the amount of solar heat coming at you, and we are 93 million miles away from the sun. Now, there's a inverse square rule that works for light or any other, like gravity, etc. But at any rate, as you get closer to the sun, the solar radiation doesn't just increase linearly, it increases exponentially. There are exponents involved here. And so if you put your hand out where these comets are near the sun, it would be extremely, extremely hot. We're talking a serious amount of energy. So let's talk a comet that is a million miles from the sun, one that SOHO would see. So this is what I find amazing, once again, that on the same page where they talk about the discovery of these comets, that they're showing the most number of comets discovered, the most prolific discoverer of comets is right near the sun. Some of the biggest comets, and then we see these comets also, some of them can discharge into the sun, and you see these enormous flares and reactions with the surface of the sun. So literally nothing makes sense here. They're talking about a comet activity near the sun, but if you put your hand out there, it would literally burn it right off. So how does this supposed ice ball weather this tremendous heat near the sun? Well, it's obviously absurd. And anything that's going to get that close to the sun that's made out of snow and ice and water ice or any other kind of ice is going to be evaporated instantaneously and would never survive as a comet. Maybe some rocky pieces of it or parts of it would remain, but the idea of a loose conglomerate of ice and chunks of material is just ridiculous. So at any rate, but that continues. But that's one of the things I found when I saw the did a search on comets. So then I looked at the one that always pops up first is Wikipedia, and that's one of my what you might call pet peeves is Wikipedia. Wikipedia is a single page that covers all kinds of topics. So if you search on comets, it would imply that the most searched page is Wikipedia relative to comets, but that's not true. Wikipedia is searched for almost everything else. So the Google criteria of giving a page high listing on the web page of Google search because it has the most hit doesn't really apply, but it's kind of cheating the system, so to speak. I heard a guy say one time, he said, I could teach you how to put your page really high on the internet, and they have all of these various tricks. But the point is that that doesn't mean it's the most popular site or the page with the most correct material. A comet, it says, is a icy small solar system body. Now, what are the first most important things? Well, of course, it's a solar system body. We all know that. Icy small. Don't think that it's anything else. And make sure that you think it's small. 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 Little. Tiny. Solar system body. It's not a planet. It's not anything else. It's just a small icy solar system body. When close enough to the sun, it says, displays a visible coma, a thin, fuzzy, temporary atmosphere, sometimes called a tail. And then it goes on to talk about the effects of solar radiation and wind on the comet nucleus. Then it says, repeating, comet nuclei are themselves loose collections of ice, dust, and small rocky particles ranging from a few hundred meters to tens of kilometers across. Comets have been observed since ancient times, been considered bad omens. Okay. And so, anyway, short-period comets originate in the Kuiper Belt or its associated scattered disks, which lies beyond Neptune. Longer-period comets are thought to originate in the Oort cloud, a spherical cloud of icy bodies in the outer solar system. Okay, so anyway, it goes on and on. So it's the standard old hockey NASA story about dirty snowballs. But the point is, small, icy. Don't think of anything big. Don't think of anything that could be electrical. And then you go to the NASA page. This is the NASA official. It's called the worldbook/comet. worldbook.html. So this is the NASA official site for, I suppose, kids. And this is, of course, what they want to do. They want to influence kids to understand this. And they go, a comet is an icy body that releases gas or dust. Most of the comets that have been seen from Earth travel around the sun in long over orbits. The comet nucleus consists of a solid core surrounded by a cloudy atmosphere called a coma, and one or two tails. Most comets are too small or faint to be seen. And I always love this part. It says, gases released energy absorbed from the sun, causing them to glow. Now we have some comets which are highly intense. They light up the sky like a light bulb. And of course, this is something astronomers don't talk about. But the point is that the comet is lighting up like a light bulb because it literally is acting like a light bulb. It has electrical current passing through it, and some of them are very brilliant, like a neon light, so to speak. And let's just go to Comets Astronomy for Kids, and this is the last one I'll go to. explanation here. A comet is a small world which scientists sometimes call a planetesimal. They are made out of dust and ice, kind of like a dirty snowball. Comets come from two places, the Kuiper Belt and the Oort Cloud. Imagine a place far away. This is from the kidsastronomy.com. Imagine a place far, far away at the very edge of the solar system, a place where millions of comets can be seen swishing around in every direction. But wait a minute. Can be seen? Nobody has ever seen these comets out there, where they talk about the icy, Kuiper Belt or the Oort Cloud. Nobody has ever seen the Oort Cloud. But they say in the kids' place, it's a place where millions of comets can be seen swishing around in every direction. Well, wait a minute. Who's seen these? NASA? No. They haven't. They've never seen a comet in the Oort Cloud. Nobody ever could see a comet in the Oort Cloud because it's a third of the way to the next star. Have they seen them near the Kuiper Belt? Well, they've seen objects in the Kuiper Belt, but they're usually planet size. Not little teeny fuzzy little things. So anyway, the point is, I'm not going to dwell on this. Okay. So at any rate, I'm not going to dwell on this because it is just the garbage science that's being pawned off on the public. And what's important, though, is that the public understands this, how important it is, and especially to influence kids. And as I said, once again, we visited a comet this past year, a NASA space probe. There was no water coming off the nucleus. There was some carbon dioxide and some it slips my mind right now, but it's one of the poisonous gases typically found in water on Earth in small amounts. I'm going to go to the NASA astrophysics page, and this talks about the Big Bang. Completing the first detailed full sky map of the oldest light in the universe. Relating back to alleged Big Bang. And then the next one is finding that dark energy is accelerating the expansion of the universe. These are all worse than pie in the sky ideas. They're simply illogical ideas that really don't make any sense. The other thing that what I'm trying to say is, with these few examples, is that the standard core misinformation, totally incorrect science, is being just stuck out there for the public to view. This is what you're being offered in 2010. So it can't possibly be true. There's fictitious science, stuff that's simply made up that has no verifiable aspect to it, yet all of the good equipment by the Tier 2 scientists, that is being used and promoted to promote this bad science. What a lot of people don't realize is, as I always say, there's a full level of science that goes on above this, and the Hubble telescope gets some time, but I guarantee you that the majority of the time is being used for things that you never see or hear about. I'm going to switch and talk a little bit about the weather. Just recap what's been going on this past week. Last week I talked a lot about weather, and there's no secret, the whole eastern coast is shut down. People sleeping in airports over Christmas vacation, trying to get to places. The storm that left New York area just now, it kind of swept off the northeast corner, and it swept up the whole eastern seaboard. People are recovering from that right now. The whole eastern part of the United States is inundated with bad weather, but that's weather system now moving off towards England, and we'll see in a couple days if that weather pattern holds, that entire storm will be in England, and the last thing those people need is a storm of that dimension to head off. Basically, it'll be getting there right around the New Year, and then heading up farther into Northern Europe, all the way up into Scandinavia. That storm should track up that way. It will hit someplace between Spain and Denmark, or possibly all of them to some degree. So that right now it's a fairly large disorganized storm, but heading that way, and it, as I said, as it tracks, it'll definitely, with all of that moisture, there's no place for the moisture to fall over the Atlantic, so that river of water will track up to Northern Europe, probably through England, etc. So we'll see that probably towards the weekend. In California, immense flooding as another river of water in the clouds comes in from above. So the California is just digging out, trying. And once things turn to mud, I'm not sure if any of you have ever been in a tropical area, but once things get wet and muddy, let me tell you, it's hard for anything to stay in place, because mud becomes almost the consistency, well, it's like molasses. The ground underneath your feet becomes like molasses. So one can imagine back in historical times, the Great Flood, which nobody likes to talk about right now as a historical event. The Great Flood must have been an extremely devastating event. It rained for 40 days and 40 nights. Once again, science trying to distort this and say, oh, it was just a breach of a water dam over by the Mediterranean, so water flowed from one area to another. No, it was 40 days and 40 nights of torrential rain. And it rained all over the world, not just one place, not just in the Mediterranean, not just in one area, and you see the results of it all over. A lot of this became obvious in the 1800s when the great expansion occurred across the western plains of the United States. That was the first time people had really gone around and recorded what the world looks like. And that's one thing I tried to do in my Atlantis to Tesla book, is to show it's a little experiment that I did with my astronomy students. I taught college, university level astronomy for a number of years. And excuse me, I did a little experiment about a third of the way through the class. This happens in every class. Students come in, sit down, you know, they've studied the lesson for the day, but you just kind of sense that, oh, they're there, but they're happy to be there. They're students, but you just want to put a little life into what's going on. And so when I kind of detect this, and remember that when I taught astronomy, I had to teach, because of the syllabus of the school, I had to teach astronomy from a standard textbook, knowing fully well that 99% of it was pure garbage. So I had to infuse in the students a way of understanding that what they were seeing was garbage, and that they had to come to that decision on their own. And then they started to ask questions. Some of the big questions then became obvious. But at any rate, I'll just explain quickly for those who, I've talked about this a few times on my show before. But here's what I did. I took the class and I said, okay, close your books. I'm gonna depart a little bit from the, standard lecture today, and I want to do a little experiment. And it only really would take about 10 minutes, so it was a small diversion. I said, here's what we're going to do. We're going to, and the students already were like, oh, good. And half of them hadn't read the lesson, you know, a standard college classroom type of situation. So I'd say, let's do something a little different today. Let's imagine, just go down the street here, someplace local, and I said, imagine something or determine something that wasn't there last week. something that was not there but is there now. And somebody'd say, well, they're digging a hole over here. They're going to start a new building, a new shopping center, a new house near my house or something. Okay, that's good. That's good. So what was there before them is what I would ask. Well, there was just a woods there. It was an empty lot next to this other house or the shopping center. It used to be a playground or woods, and an old school was there, and they tore that down and rebuilt a new school. So that's what used to be there. Okay, let's go back 2 weeks, I would say. Let's go back 2 weeks and determine something else that wasn't there. So someone would go back 2 weeks. And what I was doing is I was prepping their minds, even though they didn't know it, for something that was about to come. And I said, okay, now let's go back 6 months. Let's look at something big that wasn't here before but is here now. And so 6 months, you could usually find a building or something, a bridge or a road that was new, that was not there before. And then I'd say, well, what was there before? And typically it would be like, and as we went back in time, you might imagine that something native was there, like a woods or something that had not really been touched by man. Maybe there was a farmer's field that had only been plowed for, you know, as a farm field, and no buildings, no real development there before. Like a new factory or a new electronics company, a lot of times they build out in the edge of town where the land is cheaper and the taxes are cheaper, and they can have a big expansive building for not too much money. So they'll build it, buy up some farmland, and, you know, put it on 20 acres. That's not uncommon. So at any rate, I would go back in time 6 months, 1 year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, and then, you know, we started getting back to 20 years ago. And then I said, well, let's go back to 1930s. Let's go back to the 1900. Let's go back to 1800. And then we realized that the United States had not been really populated in the year 1800. Much of it had been unpopulated. The Great Expansion West word had not really begun. It was still populated by the Native Americans, the indigenous people who lived here. I mean, there was the 1800s was the Old West, and not much had been built. We didn't have gasoline engines, we didn't have chainsaws, we didn't have trucks to move things, we didn't have good roads. We had a very, very thin sprinkling of transportation. Around the great railway expansion had not occurred yet, so the trick was to understand what was there and how long had that been there. In other words, everything had been like throughout history up to a certain point, and then man came along and changed it. Man came along and changed it, but prior to that, everything had been pretty much as it was for thousands of years up to untold level of history. So then I go back 500 years. Okay, now we're talking about Europe. We're talking about the Black Forest in Europe being so dense that small population centers were existing in the Black Forest. The Renaissance was occurring. But, you know, the United States had really not begun as or been populated. Columbus had just discovered America, you know, or the Americas, so to speak, the islands, which were basically in the great expansion of the Spanish and the English had not begun. The Portuguese, whatever, had not begun. And so the world was a very different place. I mean, the route to the east was not there. And this is where things started to break down in the student's mind. Now, for example, this is the point at which you start to realize something, that there were great civilizations around the world that had not contacted each other since the beginning of recorded time, and that word recorded time is important. The situation is that explorers were going out and discovering new civilizations. Columbus discovered civilizations that were never even dreamt of. Then we go back in history, you know, you have Marco Polo finding the trade routes to the east. You have Vasco da Gama finding the first water route to the east for trading. And, you know, so this was opening up the world to places that they knew were there, somewhat in history, but they really didn't know how to get there. There was not a lot of contact. And then we go back another 500 years, another 500 years, another 500 years, and you start to estimate what the population of the world was at that time, and you realize that China and India were totally disjoint countries or entities, you might say, because they weren't really countries per se at that time. You go to a place like Tibet, totally isolated from the rest of the world. Let's look at Hawaii. The islands of Hawaii, the Hawaiian Islands, were becoming populated from Polynesian explorers. They were populated, and unbeknownst until Cook came along and discovered them, somewhat by accident. So the you know, sitting out there in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. Remember Darwin's discovery of the as he went around the world on the ship the Beetle and made his observations of the animal and plant life around the world, came to the conclusion that there were many similarities, but as these populations became isolated, they began to change. They became different. And it was a slow, very slow evolutionary change. They really didn't know where these animals became isolated in time, but they knew they became isolated and became a part of history and developed separately. And then it became obvious that people had done the same thing. Now, the whole point of this, of course, is to get back to the point in time where you realize that these population centers, the Chinese, the India, Europe, Northern Europe, which was separate, Africa, a whole set of distinct cultures and history there, and then the Native American populations, and what you realize, and not to mention the South American populations, and remember that about that time too, there were a lot of discoveries that the Americas were very ancient. They went back to very ancient times, and a lot of their religious beliefs went back to very ancient times. So at any rate, the whole point here is that the students began to realize that the history that they had been taught, that somehow, in fact, I just have seen this recently in National Geographic, they're still talking about the birth of the cradle of civilization being in the east, Mesopotamia and the early Persia, those areas, and that was the cradle of civilization where man first walked and spread out, and then this evolution of man, he went south, north, east, and west, and eventually became all these races. Well, as you see throughout history, as man became more mobile and had extra time on his hands so that explorers could go out, you're going to realize that this idea that people just kind of wandered around the world and all of a sudden developed into these various races, and this supposedly happened in a period of about 7,000 years, and that we have a history of the world for about 3,000 to 4,000 years of that. We have somewhat of a history. And all of a sudden you realize that there's no way that any of this could possibly happen. So at any rate, very strange look on the student's face as they began to realize that these populations existed prior to probably some event, and that they probably had communications before. But at any rate, these civilizations developed for a long period of time independently. And then as man prospered, as Western man, European man prospered, and developed, he went out and saw all of these other places and linked up, so to speak, between the civilizations with great surprise. It was certainly very surprising when the explorers came and discovered New York. The legend is that they traded Manhattan Island for some strings of beads. But the Indians didn't understand possession or ownership. They thought that, you can be on our island, thanks for the beads. Not realizing that they were going to be thrown off because they took some beads. And so this became apparent to them afterwards. I like that phrase from the movie Dances with Wolves, where the Indian chief goes, he says, they come and they take without asking. Talking of the white man as they came across the United States, pushing the Indians ever farther west and out of their homeland, eventually putting them on reservations. One of the tremendous injustices of history, along with the decimation of the Latin American populations, the indigenous populations. So at any rate, the point is that the students would then realize that history was very much different than what they had been taught. And all of a sudden I'd look out and a light would go on and you could see their faces and they were looking at one another and they would realize that, and somebody would say, that means that everything we've been taught since grade school is a bunch of garbage. About history of man, about religion, about all of the things that we have been taught, there's really a real story that's missing here, and it's a very important story. And I said, yeah, well, so what is the real story? I said, your assignment for tonight is to go to the library, and find out what the real story is. It's got to be out there somewhere. It's got to be in the library. It's just that you haven't seen it yet. So their assignment was to go and look, and so they'd come back the next class, maybe 2 days later, something like that, or over the weekend. And they'd come back, and they were furious. Students were furious. And they said, there's no information out there about our true history. There is no information that corroborates what had to have happened. Something had to have happened in the world, and we're not being told this. I said, well, what could it be? But at any rate, a lot of times you don't answer the students' questions with an answer. You let them explore that answer for themselves. But the answer inevitably was that, number one, they got angry that their whole life they had been taught ideas that couldn't possibly have been true. So at any rate, that's where we are, and at the end of 2010, those same ideas are being disseminated. Now, back in the 90s, when computers became popular, more common, the personal computer came into use, and databases became more common, it was commonly seen that computers could be used to hold information, and somebody came up with the bright idea of called information systems. In other words, if you got all the experts in the world together on all the topics that you could find, kind of professional Wikipedia, so to speak, you could put all the information into a computer, and it would be there for all time, and everybody would be happy, and all knowledge would be contained in a database. And people could go study it, and that's a great idea. The only trouble is that in the 1990s, ideas were very much more primitive than they are today. But the main core ideas, where did man come from? What are the major events in the history of the world? How did these civilizations become divided? And it must have happened at some point in history quite a while ago. We don't know exactly when. It's hard to put a date on it. But those concepts would be locked out forever. They would not be included in the database, in the knowledge database. So the problem with a database like that is that it depends on the people at the time, and time goes very quickly. Time passes very quickly, and things change. So it's very easy for the standard story to be propagated, as I say, with big flashing lights, with the guy jumping up and down the loudest, saying the most, grabbing the most attention, and that's what everybody's supposed to believe. So at the end of 2010, the year that Stanley Kubrick picked to be a year of great space adventure following the great movie 2001, when we all thought that space would be something that would be very common, spacecraft to large orbiting space stations with trips on giant spacecraft with fusion power, etc., going off to Jupiter, the expanse of looking into the universe, etc., travel. None of this has been realized. None of it. So, at any rate, looking at the end of 2010 is very telling, and one might ask, what does the future hold? Well, the reality is that the future holds nothing. Nothing better. Nothing is going to change. The standard NASA stories are going to stay the same. The NASA projects are not going to get us anywhere. There's really nothing going on at NASA. I'm trying to figure out what NASA is doing these days, and I can't figure it out. I look around their web pages, and there's really nothing going on. So, I mean, there might be a couple projects people are working on or follow-up cleanup work with some spacecraft. There's a couple small developments, but as far as the real development of space or space concepts, it's just simply not there. So at any rate, that's where we are at the end of 2010. This is not going to change. So what I hope I can do is, what I have to do is get away from this concentration on this type of topic. It doesn't do any, it doesn't provide any value. I can't waste my time anymore dwelling on these kind of things, but I think it's important to recap 2010, the past decade. This decade just flew by. Remember 2000, Y2K? This decade has flown by in a flash. It's just amazing. And a lot of good things have happened. This show has seen tremendous success in those 10 years. My work has really gone to, you know, international levels where it's commonly known amongst intelligent people. I wouldn't say it's commonly known amongst all people. And, in fact, I really wouldn't necessarily want it to be known amongst all people. It would be great, but remember that the majority of people are going to try and mix this with all of their other misconceptions. That's not good. One of the things I've always told, especially to professionals, but to the common person also, don't try and mix my information with what you think you already know, because they're not compatible. It's not like a modification of what you know. It's not like, oh, well, I kind of like his idea about the comets not being dirty snowballs, but that there are big comets and that some of them can become planets and moons and capture and disasters in the solar system. I'd want to think about that because that's disaster and, gee, I just don't want to think about disasters on planet Earth. So at any rate, the point is that I'm not a preacher, so to speak. I'm not somebody on a soapbox beating a drum. I'm not somebody that wants the whole world to... I want the people who really are digging for the truth to listen to what I'm saying. I don't want the half-truth seekers or the Big Pen crowd, the people that with the disposable, I want it for 5 minutes, I want a quick soundbite answer. That's not me. That's not my information. That's not the way it works. You have to... Some people complain about my webpage being poorly organized. Well, some people say, why don't you list all the topics that you give on your radio show? So then, because I want to listen to just these particular topics. No. It's on purpose. You have to go listen to it all. And that includes the people who don't like me. They have to listen to it all, too. They can't just, and then if they get to a point where they can't stand it anymore, then they go away. They live in their ignorance. Well, that's great. That's where they belong. And so I'm not going to help them out, and I'm not going to help anybody out by trying to give them sound bites or little pieces of information on what I do, because it's a total, complete package. There's not a bits and pieces part of it. Okay, enough of that. So looking on into the future, what I have to do is progress. I have to get back to my projects. There's a lot of work I have to do with the prime numbers. There's a lot of work I have to do with other issues, a lot of theoretical issues that I have to deal with, dealing with my work. And so that's where I have to spend my time. And so the question you have to ask is, where are you going to spend your time? The one thing you want to do is become prepared to take care of yourself. Look at the people on the East Coast. How many people, when they took off at Christmas thinking they were going to go someplace and then get back by a certain date, and I'm going to be back to work on this date, or I'm going to be back home, or I'm going to be back, I'm going to take a vacation, or I'm visiting home for the college days, and I'm going to stay a few extra days here, but then I'll take that after Christmas flight through New York City, and guess what? They're all sitting there. Whatever reason they took to be on that airport at that time, they're all sitting there, and it's going to be a long time till all those people are cleared out and get to their final destination. It's a giant mess. But this brings about a very big, major point. How delicate the infrastructure of man is. If we look at England, if we look at Europe, there's a lot of criticism of the, sorry, like Heathrow Airport, a lot of criticism of the management, because it went private, a lot of criticism of the management for not having the ability to manage that airport during the snow crisis. And in a sense, how would you be able to plan it? How are you going to plan for 32 degree temperatures in Cuba? Central China, the same. If this massive amounts of weather move in, and in the United States, we're the best prepared of any place on the planet, and it still takes them by the surprise, shuts everything down, and nobody can move. And if it lasted, here's the point, if it lasted any length of time, we would start to see a lot of dead people, starvation, lack of food, no way to get food to these people. The future, there's two parts of preparedness. There's the short-term preparedness, the one where the lights are going to come back on next week or in 2 weeks or whatever. And there's the other part of preparedness, which is long-term. What if the lights don't come back on in 2 weeks? What if they are they're just not coming back this week? That is the kind of state that we are possibly in, where these things can happen, and then you'll see a bunch of excuses from the people, from the leadership, but the point is, that's not going to help you. All of the excuses, all of the excessive attempts to cover up the what's going on around the world today with weather, it just shows one thing. Number one, people are not prepared, but it also shows something else, that the infrastructure is not prepared to handle these kind of things. So what happens? There's some delays with the hope that after a number of days the storm cleared, okay, that's great, and where do we go from here? Okay, now they can clear out. We have enough in reserve to manage. People will probably not starve to death, and things will get back to normal, and people will think twice about traveling at Christmas time again through New York City. At least the people that did that. But it's not like this hasn't happened before, and anybody really thought, what's going to happen to me? It's winter time. Am I going to be delayed, and what's going to happen if I'm delayed? Those kind of things people typically don't think of. They think that, well, my flight's going to get through, and so all is going to be well. This points out to me 2010, the last decade, the fact that the snowiest, coldest December in history is upon us. We're not done yet. For Minnesota to set records is quite a thing. for to set day after day daily records for as far as cold and snow. That's a big story, but normally you wouldn't think much of that. You would think, well, that's normal weather cycles. We can set records, not a problem. But it's setting records all over the world, and not just in the northern hemisphere. In the northern part of the where most of the land is, if you look at the equator and north, the absolute vast majority of land is north of the equator. There's very little as far as Africa. Just take a globe sometime and look at it. If you look south of the equator, there's very little land down there. You have Antarctica, which I would not exactly call a good place to live. You have the southern part of South America, and you have a little bit of Africa, and that's about it. Well, New Zealand, you know, you get down under Australia, but other than that, there's really not much land, not certainly not compared to the northern hemisphere. But right now, the northern hemisphere is in winter, and the whole northern hemisphere is experiencing this. You would expect that if it's cold in Russia, it's warm here. If it's warm here, it's cold in Russia. But it's cold all over the place, with record snow, record cold. And this certainly has to depend on cycles of the sun, or activity of the sun. So what does a person do about this? Well, simply preparedness, short-term and long-term. And many times I've advised people in the past, just shut off your utilities for a weekend. Do it as a family exercise. No water, no electricity, no gas heating your house. And of course, you don't want to do that in the winter time because the pipes would freeze. But if the water or if the electricity or the gas or both shut off, remember that you can't run your furnace without electricity. So even though it's a gas furnace, you need electricity also. It has to be a very special kind of furnace to run without electricity. So at any rate, the point is, are people prepared? What if the gas, or what if we ran out of gas, or what if some other natural event occurred which cut your gas off for the rest of the winter? What would you do? What on earth would you do? Or the electricity shut off? And these seem like unlikely conditions, but if, you know, we could have some kind of a natural disaster where a certain part of the country were all of a sudden cut off. Look at England, where the infrastructure is literally shut down. We look at the infrastructure of New York City this past week, completely shut down. Or Europe, Northern Europe, completely shut down. We're seeing this all over. A place like Cuba with 32 degree temperatures really shut down because those people cannot exist with those kind of temperatures. They're not set up for it. If you start having pipes freeze, then you have greater infrastructure problems, and you can't fix it. It's not like they have the ability to fix that. So there's really no assessment being done of the damage, for example, in Europe, in Britain. I don't see a single word any place about that. Not a single word about what might happen. Are we going to have a growing season this summer? Remember that we're in a period of very low sunspots. If you average out the sunspot activity that's been going on over the past number of years, it's simply not there. It's like pretty much zero. We're starting to get a few sunspots now. But the reality is that the sun is very weak. This is reminiscent of the Maunder Minimum. Back in the Middle Ages, a 50-year period where the sun reduced its energy output. And this was related to a time when the sunspots count was low. Obviously, energy output at the sun is, and there are other factors that apparently when the sunspot count gets low, then that's at the same time, it's not that one causes the other, but the solar output becomes low, and scientists have recently measured that the solar output has become low. So at any rate, all I want to mention is that these conditions are here, they're here to stay. And it's hard to say where this is going. We could return to normal. Predicting the weather is very, very difficult. And so clearly the climatologists who've been talking about global warming are not faring very well these days with the criticism coming from all points in the world, which it should. You have politicians forcing in global warming ideas. It's a big part of the Obama thing. It's a big part of all of the other politicians that were big in trying to force legislation or movement because of global warming. Those are good concepts, but the real concept of conservation in retaining our resources, we've been burning up the resources of the world. We burnt them up in the last 100 years, from the year 1910 to the year 2010. We've literally burnt up a very big part of the world's resources. And polluting the world, at also the situation right now, recent study just came out, people had sent this, December 28th this came out, that the Gulf of Mexico is dying. Groups dedicated to studying this are showing real data. This is not fictitious data, that the Gulf Stream has stopped, and it's very much related to the Gulf, the BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. It's really a situation that is there. I mean, it possibly has to do with some of the weather activity up the eastern seaboard right now, that Gulf Stream warmed much of that area, kept it from, just imagine the difference between snow and rain. The winter typically is the rainy season in much of the parts of the east coast of the United States. And at least with winter storms, they tend to be rain, not snow. But now they're getting snow. It's just colder. And that's the main point, that the Gulf Stream, it was fed by that warm pool of water in the Gulf of Mexico, where that would cycle out and then take a long period of time to run up the east coast of the U.S. and then off to England. Of course, that's not happening. That warm sea breeze is turning into a cold sea breeze. The snow up above is, the water moisture up above is turning into snow and falling. And in areas where they typically don't get much snow at all, they're getting real winter. So all of these conditions leading up to a situation that all I can say is become prepared, get ready for 2011, and be happy. Just take care of yourselves. I'm going to spend a lot of time working on my own, like I say, theoretical work. And I hope that people out there, like I say, be happy, be prepared, and be around people that you love and that care for you. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.